Hey, everybody. My name is Steve Nicholson, and as you just heard, I'm from Chicago. I'm retired from pastoring a church, which means I'm no longer in charge of anything. And I only go to the meetings I want to go to. And all complaint notes and letters are forwarded to somebody else. And it's wonderful. But I always have to add, but you have to earn it. And you don't get to retire till you get permission. So no early permissions allowed, generally. Because, you know, it takes about 20 years to really, at minimum, to build a really good church. Minimum. It takes a good long time. And what we want to build are churches that will last at least three generations. You don't want it to die when you're done. Like, we want it to go at least a couple more, if possible. So take some time to do that. So here's what I want to say. First rule of leadership is show up. The second rule of leadership is be there at the end, and all the goodies come at the end. The end is going to be the last 20 years of ministry, the last 20 years of your life, from 50 to 70. Although I'm starting to think I'm going to have to turn that into 30 because I'm in my 70s and it's actually still getting better. So, you know, maybe it'll go a little longer, you know, if God allows. So, but that's the most fruitful time at the end. That's where you have the greatest opportunities, the greatest amount of influence. And if, you know, if God is good to you and likes you, he even lets you retire partway along the way and you can only do the meetings that you want to go to. So all the goodies come at the end, but you have to get there. Like, you got to make it to the end. You know, I joined the Vineyard when I was in my early 30s, and most of my peers and the people that I ministered alongside with during that time period did not make it to the end. Over half, gone, out. Some of them crashed and burned. You know, some variation on moral failure. Some of them just quit. A couple of them died, so I guess I can't blame them for that. But mostly they either quit or they crashed. And they missed out on all the good parts. So this seminar is about how do you make it to the good parts? And the interesting thing, I'm kind of moving into the first point, but, you know, I've done this a lot, so I'm starting to just kind of chat. But right when I've seen this a lot, like right when pastors are at that point where it's going to get really good, they get this intense pull and obsession that they should quit then. It's from the evil one. Like, because he can see what's coming, and he wants to get you to quit so it doesn't happen. So how do you do it? How are you going to make it to the end? And the first thing I want to say to you is you got to get a warfare mentality. Like, you got to stop trying to pretend we're in peacetime. We are not in peacetime. We're in wartime. And you've got to be on your toes and alert. You have to understand the enemy is going to try to get you to quit or get you to crash. And because we're taking his territory. You do understand that we're robbers. Right? We're here to rob the enemy of his people and his territory by starting churches and leading people to Jesus and turning them into disciples. We're here to rob the kingdom of darkness, and he knows it. And he's going to try to stop it. And it starts the minute you say yes. The minute you say, I'm going to lead a church, I'm going to do this ministry, The minute you say, yeah, I'm really going to pursue God with everything, the minute you say, yes, I'm going to plant a church, there's immediate counterattack right away. I remember one guy talked, he came in, sat down, we had this discussion, how God was talking to him and his wife, and agreed, yep, I'm going to plant a church. Within a week, he was diagnosed with throat cancer. Just boom, just like that, right away. That this war is dirty war. It's like the Ukrainians and the Russians. It's a dirty war. Like there are no civilians in this war. The enemy will attack you in every weak point he can find. He will attack your spouse. He will attack your children. He will attack your stuff. He'll attack your car, your house, your dog, anything that he can use to get you to quit. He will attack because it's dirty war. He'll wait till you're weak and then he'll just unload. He will attack you through your best friend. And it happens to every church planter. My wife and I led Vineyard Church Planters planting in the U.S. for 25 years. And, of course, we had a massive team of people. You know, we were identifying people and training people all over the U.S. and trying to get them going. So, but during those 25 years, we planted 750 churches. And I'm telling you, every one of them was attacked by the enemy. And every one of them, part of the attack at one particular point in their history, was from somebody they considered their best friend. The mouth of the enemy speaking to them through their friend. And the way it goes is you think they're your best friend, you went on vacation together, you think they're 100%, and all of a sudden they're saying, your motives are not good, God didn't call you, you shouldn't be leading this church, you know, you're disqualified, you're not good enough, blah, blah, blah. That's demon talk, folks. That's demon talk, and it's coming out of the mouth of your friends. Because the demons can sometimes insinuate themselves or deceive people where they can speak to them. It happened to Peter. All right? Remember that story in the Bible? It happened to Peter. And Jesus says, get behind me, Satan. All right? So when it happens, just understand, it's not your friend. It's your real enemy. Just using this particular opportunity to try to get at you. So you got to be aware you're in a war. You know, when we were traveling with Wimber in the early days, when we first started coming over here, he would do this giant conference and there'd be like 2,000-3,000 people. And he'd invite, you know, 10 or 12 Vineyard, U.S. Vineyard churches to send a team of 10 or 15 people. So we'd all, like, recruit some people, and we were all going to go with Wimber to this conference. We paid our own way, and we'd all go together. And there'd be, like, 10 or 15 of us from each church, and so there'd be, like, a couple hundred team members, sometimes as many as 400. So when people tell you, I traveled with John Wimber, just understand, that doesn't mean they were in the same car or even in the same airplane or that they ever even talked to the man. When they say, I traveled with John Wimber, it doesn't mean anything except that they were there in those early days. We would go to these things, visible signs and wonders. Like in this country, I have seen the blind see. I remember one time, in Belfast, 1987, bad times in Belfast. A blind man got healed, and he literally pulls his cane out. He had one of those fold-up cane things, hands it to one of the women on our team, says, I guess I won't be needing this anymore. You know, we saw the blind see. We've seen deaf people here. We've seen the lame walk. And in the middle of that happening, inevitably, every single time, somebody on the team starts thinking, you shouldn't have come. Nobody gets healed when you pray for them. God doesn't actually love you. You're not really a Christian. Nobody on this team likes you. You should never spend all that money and come on this thing. Yada, yada. Do you understand what I'm talking about? Because it's happened to you somewhere, somewhere, somehow. It's happened to you. That's the enemy trying to speak. And then they'd isolate themselves. They'd end up in the corner watching all this. All this miracles happening, they'd be missing out on all of it. So pretty soon we figured that out and we said, if you're going to come with us on the team, you have to make a simple commitment to us. That if you're one of the people that gets attacked that way, and we described it, you must promise us that you will immediately tell somebody. Just tell somebody. Tell somebody on the team, this is what's happening. And they would tell us, we'd pounce on them like bees on honey. We'd pray for 5 minutes, pop that thing like popping a soap bubble, and they'd be good for the rest of the week. You see, we have weapons that are more than sufficient to turn back the attacks of the enemy, but you have to use them. You have to use them, and that means you've got to recognize that you're under attack. So that's going to happen. You've got to be ready to engage in warfare. And a couple of things about that. Particularly if you are carrying any kind of leadership role, that puts you higher up on the target list. Or if you're prophetically gifted, that puts you higher on the target list. I won't go into exactly why, but prophetic people get moved up. In fact, the more prophetic they are, the higher up they go. And if they're some of the ones, the most gifted people, they have had multiple attempts on their life. Like they'll report like 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 near misses where the enemy's trying to kill them before they can do this ministry. So I guess so. Only one time. Yeah, he tried to kill you, didn't he? It's not the first time that's happened. Okay, so it's a real thing. It's a real thing, folks. You know, you're gonna move up in the target. So if you're one of those people, you need to recruit intercessors to pray a wall of protection around you, your spouse, your kids, and your stuff. One time, we were praying for Cindy and I and the kids. We forgot to pray for our house, and while I went on a ministry trip, the ceiling fell down for no apparent reason. Like, no flooding, no burst pipe, no reason. Just, you know, fell down in one of the rooms. Just completely. And it's sort of like, oh, yeah, we forgot to have them pray for the house. So, you know, it's easier to get them praying than it is to buy a new car. So I strongly suggest, and if I have a conversation with somebody and they say, I'm going to plant a church, I'll tell them, your first step is to get your intercessor praying because you're in the hot spot already before you've done anything. Also, you're going to have a harder time finding a house in the place you're trying to move to than you've ever had in your life. He will obstruct in unbelievable ways to keep you from getting even in place. Okay, so the intercessors are critical. God calls a lot of people to intercession. All those people doing the, groan, you know, people crying out. You know who I'm talking about, right? You know those people? That's intercession. That's a gift of intercession. They put them to work. You know, get them praying for you. And because an ounce of prevention's worth a pound of cure. But you will be attacked, but you have weapons. They'll protect you. They'll get you through. But you have to use them. Okay, so you just got to have a warfare mentality and be aware of it. I mean, I had a really good friend. Enemy got into his wife's head. And she was deceived and just decided she didn't love him anymore, didn't want to be married to him, and divorced him. Blew him right out of ministry. Another really good friend, really doing great stuff for God, all of a sudden was having these extreme physical symptoms. The doctors were treating it like asthma. She carried it around for 3 months, and then they discovered she was having a heart attack and had been having it for 3 months. And when we prayed for her, it turned out it was a demon that was trying to kill her. When we got rid of the demon, her heart function went way up to a level they said she would never see if it was purely natural. Okay? I'm telling you, it's a dirty war. So you have to be ready to fight. Fight, fight, fight. You got to fight. All right, I'll just stop right there. Questions? Before I leave that point, questions? Yeah, I think I want to do it that way today.
The question was, so you started in Dubuque. What was the story between there and arriving in Chicago?
Oh, well, I didn't live in Butte. Okay. I lived down the road from Butte. That means 200 miles. In Montana, they didn't have a daytime speed limit because you could drive 100 miles and not meet another car. So it was a couple hundred miles away, but you could get there in an hour. So you just have to go to America to get a nice a sense of this. But it is ridiculous, is it not? Yeah, so anyway, I couldn't get out of there fast enough, and I went to university in Minnesota. And the people in Montana said I went back east to go to college, to go to uni. And when I graduated from there, I had some debts I needed to pay off, and so I got a job with Inland Revenue in Chicago. And I thought, I'm going to have to work for a little while and pay off my debts before I can go to seminary. But there was a big problem. Where am I going to go to church? And I couldn't find a church I could stand going to. So long story short, I found some friends who wanted the same kind of church as I did, and we got together and started a church. And that's the church I've led for 45 years. That's the short version. It's more loose. I mean, I think, there will be times when what you want to do is you call the whole church to pray. You know, times where, you might even call the whole church to fast and pray. You know, there will be times when we recognize, this is a very intense period. There will be intense periods, right? Which usually happen right before a breakthrough's about to happen, all right? Not after, right before. There'll be just intense battle. So you call everybody to pray. So it's not like only intercessors. The thing about the intercessors is, in terms of building a wall of protection, you want people who pray nearly constantly. People who will pray for you like daily. And those are the people that do that. They can't help themselves. Over here. That's good. Did everybody hear the question? She asked, do you have any, I was talking about how, the enemies can speak through your friend. She says, how can you tell the difference between it's like wisdom from your friend and when it's the enemy, okay? When it's wisdom, or even just, let's call it legitimate criticism, it's specific. It's kind of sharp. It's not presumption. It's like, when you should not have done X, when you said this, that was hurtful. Okay? That's the way the Holy Spirit brings conviction and repentance that we need. It's like a scalpel. It's sharp and it's precise, and it goes only to the thing that needs to change, right? That's good. That's what we want. The people that love us give us that. Like, when people give us that kind of criticism, they're proving their loyalty to us. Do you understand that? I always tell people, if you got something that you think I did wrong and you tell me, that's loyalty. That's what my friends do. That's what my wife does. You know, if you tell everybody except me, okay, that's not loyalty, all right? So tell me. Tell it to me. I want it. That's loyalty. But if it's the enemy, it'll be like this. It'll be like a club. It won't be like a knife. It'll be questioning your motives. Like, you just want to get rich. You just want to have power. It'll be questioning your call. God didn't really call you. This is how the enemy does. Did God really say? Like, that's from Genesis 2 on. Did God really say? Okay, that's the enemy. Okay, he's trying to get you to quit. All right, let me tell you something. Never, ever doubt in the darkness what you've heard in the light. All right, when you're here in an environment like this and the power of the Spirit's coming on you and God speaks to you, you hang on to that for all you're worth. That's the light. And when things get rough, when it gets dark, and it will, don't doubt. Don't question. Because then you're just giving power to the evil one. Don't do that. Okay, that's how you tell the difference. Hand in the back. All right, why does God allow that attack to happen if he can protect us from anything? Because your destiny is to rule and reign with Christ, and you need to get trained how to do it. So he doesn't do it for you. Okay? Like, you need to learn how to fight the enemy, not rely on somebody else doing it for you. You need to learn to use your authority in Christ, because that's part of your destiny. Like when I talk about healing, I tell people, do not ask God to heal the person that's in front of you. You heal them with the authority and the power that you've been given. You do it, because you are supposed to learn the family business. So that when we get to ruling and reigning of Christ, we're ready. You get it? All right, that's why. Yep. Yep.
Through a prophecy. And literally half an hour ago, my fiance is now talking about leaving me because of that.
What did I tell you?
Literally within half an hour.
Within half an hour.
I told her that I felt that call in my life, and she basically decided that that's incompatible. We've been together for 3 years.
Did you all hear that question? Okay. He said yes to God, to a call to church plant, and within 30 minutes, his fiance wants to break up with them. Okay? So, what do you do?
At the moment, I'm a freelancer as well.
So yeah. What do you do
about that situation? Here's what you do. Here's what you do. You get a couple of her friends and a couple of your friends. You tell them what happened, and you ask them to pray. That's all you got to do. That's all you really can do. Well, no, you're going to have to sit down and have a painful conversation, but start with the prayer. You know, a few years back, one Sunday morning, this guy in our church comes in, and he waits till like 5 minutes before we're getting up to preach, right? And he says, you know, I don't love my wife and kids anymore. I don't want to stay married. I don't want to stay in that house. I don't want to be around those kids. I'm leaving. And of course, he tells us just before we're getting up to preach, because he doesn't want us to be able to say anything or respond. So if you're like the preaching pastor, this is going to happen to you. Okay. So what we did was at the next staff meeting, we prayed for 5 minutes. God, You need to intervene in this situation. You need to do something. The next week, we prayed for 5 more minutes. God, you need to intervene. You need to do something. And the next Sunday, he comes in, and he says, oh, I'm so thankful you guys prayed for me. I don't know what was wrong with me. It was like I was under a spell. And he said, all of a sudden, one morning I woke up, and it was like this enchantment was lifted off me, and I realized I do love my wife, and I do love my kids, and I don't want to leave. Okay, folks, that's spiritual warfare. Your weapons have to be used. Use your weapons. They work. All right, I have to press on because we're going to run out of time. All right, number 2. You want to make it to the end? Be a learner. Be somebody that's always learning. Take the classes. Go to the meetings. Come to the seminar. ask questions. Find a couple of mentors that are a little bit ahead of you and call them up. Most vineyard pastors will be happy to help you if you ask them. You know, there are a few guys that are too disorganized to answer the phone. Well, just skip them and go to the next person, okay? But find somebody who will answer the phone or answer the email. They'll get back to you. They'll talk to you and ask them questions. And I'll tell you what, all the church plants I've coached in my life, it's basically come down to 2 kinds of people. There's the learners who ask questions, they come to the meetings, they go to the classes, they read the books, they talk to their mentors, they get a coach. I have never seen one of them fail. And then there's another group, doesn't call anybody, doesn't ever ask questions, never ask for advice from anybody. They don't come to the meetings. They isolate themselves. And they say, nobody helps me. And the reason I failed is because the vineyard didn't give me enough support. I had one of them say it to my face one time. And I told him, that is a bunch of BS. And I said, look, I told you to do this, this, and this. I named several things I told him to do before he left. And you did all of the things I told you not to do, and you did nothing that I told you to do. And now you want to say it's our fault that you failed? And he said, that's what I love about you. You always tell it like it is. And I said, well, it didn't help, did it? So don't be like that. Be like the other ones. If you will, like, be a learner, this is the thing about being a family. If you'll be a learner, you will get what you need to get through even the worst stuff. You know, there will be worse stuff. There must have been 1,000 days I wanted to quit. But I didn't. Okay? You'll go through tough times. But if you will be a learner and stay connected, let the family help, you'll make it to the good times that come at the end. So be a learner. Number 3, put a priority on connection and relationship, which kind of goes with that, you know. Like, we need each other. Nobody stands alone in the end. Nobody stands alone. If you're going to fight this war, you know, if you go off to war by yourself, guess what's going to happen? You're going to be a casualty. You know, you that's not what you want. If you're going to war, you want the biggest group of people around you can get. You know, you want the most support you can possibly get. And so go to the area meetings. Go to the staff meetings. Go to the prayer meetings. Like, get up and go. You know, be there. Because the relationship is actually the thing that you often most need. You know, sometimes, well, I'll tell you, you know, like, when I was leading, we had an area. We have about 20 vineyard churches in the Chicago area. And most of them planted from our church. Our church was running around 1,400 people on a weekend. None of the other churches was over like 300. They were all smaller churches. And, you know, a lot of people would go to that meeting and they would say, oh, I don't want to keep going to that meeting because nobody ever talks about the issues I'm dealing with in my church. Because the issues you face when you got 1,200 people you're trying to take care of and the issues you face when you got 300 people you're trying to take care of are a little bit different. But I always went. Why? Because it wasn't about what I could get out of it in terms of mentorship. I had people I could call when I needed input for what, how do I handle this many people. I had those people, but I needed the ones that were near me for relationship and prayer. And we'd go around and we'd share like our needs and our challenges and our victories, and we'd pray for each other, and that was everything. Okay, so stay in relationship. Don't get isolated, because look, what the enemy wants to do is get you isolated, then get to you somehow and get you to quit, strike the shepherd, then scatter the sheep and pick them off and destroy them one by one. All right? So if you don't get this right, a lot of people's families will literally be destroyed. Oh, and I've seen it happen. Like, horrible things will happen to them. Horrible things will happen. So you got to make it. You got to make it through. And it's not that hard. Those of you who are senior pastors, you heard John's list of 20 things to do on Wednesday? Hands? How many of you heard that? If you are a leader in this room and you weren't here for that, fine, get it. I think it's going to be posted, isn't it? Do you know? Well, agitate until it is posted, because it's worth it. That list of 20 things, I'm sure they'll be happy to give it out widely. It's like priceless. It'll save your life. Okay? So, then there's some things you need to be aware of. Okay? So those are things to do. Here's some things you got to watch out for besides the warfare. And the first thing I'd say is watch out for entitlement. Now, entitlement comes like this. You've sacrificed so much. You gave up X, Y, Z. Therefore, I'm entitled to this position, this opportunity. I'm entitled to get more money. I'm entitled to this. I'm entitled to that. You start to feel entitled. Then what happens is your entitlement gets disappointed, as it always will. Be disappointed. Because you're just not going to get your things your way all the time. You're just not. You know, it's not always going to go your way. They're not always going to choose the speaker you want, and they're not always going to sing your favorite songs, and so on. It's just not always going to be your way. So your entitlement gets disappointed, then you get bitter, and you get angry. And when you're bitter and angry and entitled, you start trying to get comfort. And the comfort causes you to fudge the edges of what's moral and what's appropriate. And then you get more angry and you start mistreating the people around you. Okay? And the whole thing will accelerate until the devil's got the trap fully set, and then you will be exposed and destroyed. All right? So understand. When you said yes to Jesus, you signed up for the army. You signed up as a slave, which means you're not entitled to anything. You're not entitled to success. You're not entitled to comfort. You're not entitled for it to be easy. Most of the people that sign up with Jesus Army, it's hard. You know, some of them in fear of their lives. You know, talk to some of your Iranian refugees and you'll understand, you know, you're not entitled to anything. I have found that it works a lot better to just decide I'm a slave. And I just do what I'm asked. You know, my job is to obey the latest orders. And however that works out is however that works out. You know, about 15 years ago, the Vineyard USA had to choose a new national director. And it basically came down to me and another guy, my friend, named Phil Strout. They were choosing between the two of us. I probably had a good 40, 50 words. Oh, it's going to be you, Steve. But when it came down to it, it wasn't me. They picked Phil. And at that point, I realized, I'm like on a knife edge here. Because, you know, there's the inevitable feel of, they didn't pick me. So you can feel rejection, right? You can feel rejection at that point. And I thought, if I let this go that way, I could be sliding into, well, I should have been picked. That's entitlement. Or it could turn into bitterness, and then I would be on the bad path. So I decided, here's the way to go. I'm going to be thankful they didn't pick me, and I'm going to be Phil's number one supporter going forward. I will be his best friend and his greatest supporter, and there will never be a word of hesitation or doubt about his leadership that comes out of my mouth. It worked great. I mean, it wasn't very long till I was truly grateful that they had picked him and not me, because I was having a whole lot more fun than he was. Turns out sometimes getting picked for something is not a reward. And, you know, he was able then to entrust me with some really significant projects and things that I got to do along the way, and it was just wonderful. And it opened up the door in my life and my ministry to even yet greater influence. I'm here today probably because of that decision right then. If it had gone the other way, I probably wouldn't have been here. So I'm just want to say, like, at some point you're going to be there on that knife edge. Like, something's not gone your way. Something's not gone the way you expected. Like, make the right decision in that point, okay? Like, understand, sometimes you just have to talk to yourself. I'm a slave. I'm not entitled to anything here. Or, you know, maybe you don't like the language of slave. Okay, try dead then. I have been crucified with Christ, and I no longer live, but Christ lives through me. When you're dead, you don't care, because you're dead. Yeah, we could try servant. That'll work. Although in America, servant doesn't work, because sometimes servants aren't very servant-y. But dead works. And, you know, in a certain sense, I think that's what we aspire to, right? To be crucified with Christ so that his life might more fully live through us. If you're dead, you're dead. Dead to everything. If you still are caring about what happens to you, if you're still caring about your pride, you're not dead yet. If you're tempted towards bitterness? Oh, yeah, okay. One, bless your enemies. or whoever is the object of your bitterness. Start blessing them. Start becoming their best friend. It's really hard to do that and stay bitter. Right? Seems to me there's something in the Sermon on the Mount about that. You know, do we still believe in the Sermon on the Mount? You know, so let's start. Bless your enemies. One, two, find out what God has for you next. Like, turn around and look to the future. What's next? Maybe examine your original expectations. A lot of times our bitterness is based on our expectations that were actually never communicated to anybody. Nobody actually agreed to those expectations, but you had those expectations, and then inevitably they were disappointed because they weren't realistic. You know, when I first became a part of the national board in the Vineyard, I was pretty young. I was only like 33, 34. They put me on the national team of the U.S. And everybody else on there were like people that were like my heroes. You know, people that I'd seen in the conferences, and they'd been speaking, and they'd been praying over us on everything. And I got there, and let's just say some of them weren't the same in private as they were on the stage. And it really threw me. Like, I was not expecting that. And I could have gotten bitter right then. So it happened right around the time I got a chance to talk to John Wimber. And I said, John, like, how do you handle this? Like, you know all the dirt on everybody. And he did. You know all the dirt on everybody. How do you handle it? He says, you mean like, how do you not get cynical? And I said, yeah. And he says, look, I know there's some bad apples in the mix. There'll always be bad apples in the mix. You understand what he's just done? He reset my expectations. There'll always be bad apples in the mix, he said. And then he said, don't let the bad apples steal the joy of serving with the good apples. He says, you're going to get to serve alongside some of the best people on the planet. And he started naming names. People like Rich Nathan. Does that ring a bell to anybody here? And he went down another list. I'm telling you, the list was perfect in the light of history. All the good apples he named proved to be good apples. That made it all the way to the end, like Rich. And the bad apples that he didn't name, let's just say they disappeared over time. You know? So recalibrate your expectations a little bit. You know, maybe your expectations just were not realistic. Like, you thought there was going to be a perfect church, and it turns out there's people in it. When I was in uni, I was like so zealous for God, but I was a real idealist and perfectionist and kind of getting angry at the church. And one of my friends took me to one of these, you know, prayer meetings, because we had all these prayer meetings all over the place that sprung up, and his parents had this Catholic charismatic prayer meeting that they went to. And so we went there, and at the end of the meeting, we just got introduced to the guy that was leading, and I didn't even think we'd have that much of a conversation. And all of a sudden he turned to me and he said, you know what your problem is? He says, your problem is you're looking for the perfect church. Dead right. And he said, the problem is if you ever did find the perfect church, you'd probably join it and ruin it. That was the best rebuke I've ever gotten. Just kind of popped that thing, well, you know, your expectations. So you can get angry and bitter just because of your own expectations. So re-examine your expectation. Does that help? Okay. Beware of friendship with the world. Like, I mean, 1 John, I mean, and the epistles of John in general, because he comes to this theme several times, very clear. You can either love God or you can love the world, but you can't do both. And by the world, he means the world system, the prevailing culture, the prevailing way of doing things. He says, you know, if you love the world, then the love of God, it's not in you. Because this world is not our home. All right? And I just want you to know, I've seen some people fall in love with the world, and they never made it to the end. They wanted to impress the world. They wanted the world to like them. They wanted the world's approval. They wanted to be approved. They wanted to not be shamed, because, of course, it's all about shame and honor these days, right? They wanted to not be shamed. But I'm telling you, as long as you proclaim that Jesus is the rightful king, the world will not accept you. And don't be under any illusion, because the world is under the control of the evil one. And it's all about who the rightful king is. So don't think that any compromise will make them love you, short of giving up your faith altogether. So just don't go down that path. It's a kiss of death. You know, understand, we're not supposed to be at home. We're not supposed to be at home here. It's not supposed to feel comfortable. It's not supposed to feel right, because it's not. It's not right. Not till the king is on his throne. All right, let's see. Beware of the potential of not just moral failure, but of false accusations. Okay, so look. Our history has been the church covering up legitimate accusations and crimes as a sort of short-sighted attempt to protect themselves, which is like sort of like, I don't know what they were thinking. But that's our history. That's all been exposed, and I think God had his own hand in that, exposing all of that. Okay, that's the judgment of God. God's judgment always comes with exposing the truth. Okay, so he exposes the truth. But now the culture swung the pendulum way over to the other side, and now it's sort of like victims rule. And if somebody makes any kind of accusation, you're guilty until proven innocent. Are you with me now? All right. Look, if you're leading, you're going to make somebody mad. Somebody's going to be angry at you. Like, there's always going to be somebody who has aspired their whole life to be the lead worship singer on a worship team, and you're going to tell them you can't carry a tune. And it's not going to happen. You're going to crush their dream. You will. You'll crush their dream. Or, you know, some other variation of that. There are times when you have to tell people the truth and you have to make choices on behalf of the group, and you can't make everybody happy any of the time. All right? So somewhere down the line, it's not too hard to imagine somebody gets bitter because you crushed their dream, and 30 years later they make an accusation. You crushed my dream. That's spiritual abuse, they'll say. Are you following me? In the current climate, you're done at that ministry at that point. Like, boom, everybody just jumps on the bandwagon. And it's all over social media and da 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 da. So here's what I recommend. If you are a senior pastor or you're a trustee, you're in a position of that, rewrite your bylaws to build in due process that protects legitimate victims, that gives a pathway for legitimate victims to speak up and get rid of the bad apples, all right? Because you want to get rid of the bad apples. You want justice, and you want to do a good job of protecting kids, especially. So you got to have that, but also do a process that screens out false accusations born out of just bitterness or resentment because somebody didn't get their way. You follow me? It'll take some work. You'll have to think about it. You know, but if anybody that's got legal training will understand the principle. It's not new. I mean, we've been working on this for a good 700 years. So, you know, but you've got to have it written in place in your governing documents or you could be in trouble. It could happen tomorrow. All right? And I'm seeing it happen. I've seen it happen to two of my friends in the last 3 months. All right? So it's serious. And as we get further down the road and more at odds with the culture, the motivation on that side to try to decapitate the church through false accusation grows.
An example of what happened
to one of those three? They had to resign their churches and give up their ministry.
Even though
they weren't even allowed to know who was making the accusations or what the accusations were. One in the U.S. and one here.
Huh? How do you counteract that? How do you avoid that?
An ounce of prevention is a pound of cure. And more than likely, one of those churches, at least for sure, I think the church is, it was a church of 1,500, almost 2,000 people, it'll probably die. I'm imagining the church will be gone in a year. Okay, just tore the church to pieces. Okay, scatter the sheep. You know, strike the shepherd, scatter the sheep. All right, so I'm just simple warning. This is where this is the nature of the game here. Cover your tracks in that sense. Obviously. They don't even wait for the investigations to be done.
Oh, okay. Is that because they haven't got the due process?
There's no deep due process. Right.
The damage is done already.
The damage is done already. That's right. So you have to build in something so that there's some kind of protection. So you can say, we have a process. And it's a good process, and we're going to work our process. And no, they don't resign yet, not till they're proven guilty. Do you understand what I'm saying? And you have to be able to stand up in front of the news cameras and say, regardless of your shaming predilections, we have to follow our stated process, which we've built into our governing documents. And as long as you're following the process that's in your documents, nobody actually can fault you.
Is that part of the Vineyard governing documents?
It is not. Yet. But I'm just telling you need double protection in that, because you see, the way the legal thing has worked, you have separate governing documents locally and nationally, and the national can't fully protect you locally. Are you here? I mean, it's sometimes challenging for Americans to understand your legal system, but I'm pretty sure I got that one right. So you have to have it at both locations. Okay, great. Now, in light of that, I want to talk to you a little bit about spiritual abuse, because most of these accusations are going to end up coming under spiritual abuse. And I want to start by saying it is a little bit easy to slip into spiritual abuse and not quite realize what you're doing if you haven't thought about it. So it is important to kind of have a sense about this and some thought. Primarily, of course, what you're talking about is the recognition that you have spiritual authority in the church, especially if you're the senior pastor, you have authority. That's power. It's a certain kind of power. That's power. And power can be misused. And spiritual abuse is when that spiritual power gets misused in a way that's not intended or not legitimate. So it's about misuse of power. So the first way is just using your power for personal benefit. Like if you use that power to benefit yourself or to bolster your position, that can be spiritual abuse. So if you use your power to get more money than the trustees would normally want to give, or to get special favors from people, use your power to get people to, you know, come to your house and clean your house every week and do, you know, personal services, kind of off the books. All right, you understand that that is an abuse of your authority if you do that, because your authority is given to you for the sole purpose of serving the church and the people in the church. Like, you're meant to be a public servant. They're not meant to be your servant. Okay, so it's spiritual abuse if you start using your authority or power to benefit yourself. Okay? Or if you use it to put yourself above any kind of question or criticism. All right? If you start taking the attitude, you know, nobody can criticize me. Nobody can ask any questions about decisions that we've made. Okay, that's a bad sign. Okay? Because remember what we said earlier? That, like, the people who are truly loyal to you and love you will question you and criticize you if you do something wrong. And as well they should. Preferably as early as possible. Okay? So if you start taking attitude, no, I'm above all that, that's a problem. And of course, the way you prevent that kind of spiritual abuse is just, again, understand, I'm a servant here. And my job is to serve this church and the people in it, not to serve myself. And you've got to do it in such a way that any hostile person who comes and looks at what's really happened will have no question. All right? So what you get paid should be something you wouldn't be embarrassed to be published in The Guardian, you know, or The Independent, you know, depending on which one gets a hold of it first. and so on. The second kind of spiritual abuse is what I would call crossing boundaries. And this is something the reformers 500 years ago started wrestling with, because you had different kinds of authority. You had state authority, and you had church authority, and you have family authority. And the idea is, the state authority, the authorities, you know, we have a scripture in the Bible, you know, the authorities of government are established by God, who rule, as you know, the phrase is, you know, they rule with the sword to execute justice. And of course, sometimes they're just and sometimes they're not, but God has established them in general as part of authority. Okay. And then we have church authority. The state authority, the governing authority, does not have the right to dictate to the church authority what they believe or who leads them or whatnot. Although in this country, you guys still don't have that quite sorted out. Although in the vineyard, it's no problem. But if you're in the Church of England, yeah. Sort of a little bit mushy on that point. That was the first thing the Americans wanted to clear up. You know, state authority versus church authority. That's not what we're primarily concerned about, though, at the moment. Although it could happen again. Because the state authority is getting unhappy with the church right now. What we're concerned about is church authority wanting to dictate to families and individuals outside the lines of authority that the church authority has. So in the church, if you have authority, you're a pastor in the church or you're a trustee in the church, you have authority in the boundaries of the church. That means you have the right to decide where we meet, what we do, what we teach, what we believe, what we preach about, you know, what time we meet, who's going to be the worship leader, etc. Internal to the church decisions, you have the right to exert authority in that boundaries under the way that we set it up, which is usually a balanced thing. You know, like pastors can't just willy-nilly do everything they want. You have trustees who are independent, preferably that you are not related to, who at least oversee the legal and financial aspects of what's going on. Okay? Yes, that's what we want. You have authority there. You do not have authority to point at somebody and say, you have to marry this person. All right, are you with me? Because when you do that, what? You've crossed a boundary. You've gone out of your lane. You know, you are now, you're intruding on a person's personal authority. Are you following me here? That's spiritual abuse if you cross the boundary. Now, here's where it gets slippery. You know, I got pretty close to this when I was young. And the way it happened was I started feeling like my job as the pastor is to make sure nobody makes any mistakes. And I wasn't making any distinction between what's moral and what's wise. There's a difference. Okay? What's moral are the things we have in the Bible in black and white, and you can point to it and read it, and it's very clear. Such and such is not approved by God in one way. Or, you know, it's moral. It's in the Ten Commandments or whatever. You know, it's a moral issue. It's in there in black and white. That's a moral issue. But there's a lot of things that aren't under those categories. And then it's an issue about what's wise. Like going into debt. The Bible kind of gives advice, don't go into debt, but it doesn't make it a moral issue. All right? So if somebody maybe chooses to go into debt, I would say, I don't think that's a good idea. But it's wisdom, not morality. You can't treat them the same way. So here I am, I'm not making a distinction between those two, and I feel like my job is to make sure nobody makes any mistakes. Well, what it seemed like the more I thought that, the more determined my people were to make mistakes. Like, they actually resented it. And now looking back, I realize rightfully so. What we said at the time was, oh, they have authority problems. They have problems with authority. They have father issues, blah, blah, blah. The problem was me, not them. I was trying to exert authority over them that wasn't legitimately mine. Finally, God said, look, I let you make mistakes. Why are you not letting them make mistakes? Like, I was feeling like good leadership was keeping people from making mistakes. But in doing so, I was keeping people from growing. Because you need mistakes to grow. Are you following what I'm saying? So there was a period of time this required getting up in front of the church and apologizing for the way I had been leading because I'd been too controlling. I was pushing on that boundary of personal authority in ways that weren't legitimate. Are you with me? And here's the funny thing. Once I got that squared away, and I learned to be a better servant of people and help them grow. It was the most amazing thing. They started doing everything I wanted and copying everything I did. And I find myself sometimes saying, all right, I'll give you my advice, but don't just automatically do it. Like, I want you to think about this a little bit, because I'm not going to take actual responsibility for what your decision is. You know, I want you to pray. I want you to ask God. I want you to grow up. Are you following what I'm saying? I'm almost begging people, don't just automatically follow my authority. It changed the whole game. So watch out for your boundaries. Question. Yep. Okay, so if the things that are moral issues, I can say flat out, this is wrong, this is right. These are moral issues based not on my opinion, but on the book. But they have to be clear in the book. Now, these days, nothing's clear to anybody. Truth is obscured by everybody and twisted. But if you just dial back a little bit to where rationality still reigned, you know, if it's clear in the book, it's clear. And you can, and you are entitled then to say it's wrong. Adultery is wrong. That is against God's law. And you can say, if you break that law, you can't lead in this church. At least not. Maybe eventually, with repentance and restitution and whatnot, but you can't lead in this church now, because we got to end the book. Okay, if they break the law, that law. But if they break something that's a matter of wisdom, I can't do that. Are you with me here? It's sort of like, no. If it's a matter of wisdom, if they ask for my advice, I can give it to them. But they're entitled to be foolish. Maybe. Depends on how foolish they were. It is within the bounds of the church. I can point them as leaders, yes. What I would say is, when people make contextual issues, sometimes the context does rule, but make sure that you're getting the truth on the context and that you're dealing with all the relevant scriptures. In terms of tithe, there's a lot of scriptures, not just one. And there's a whole wide thing. And beware, because I've seen a number of cases where people make assertions about the context that are actually, if you dig a little deeper, completely false. You know, people will say things about the ancient world, and the ancient world didn't know about any XYZ, you know. Well, no, they did. You know, the ancient world, they were actually pretty smart people. You know, they knew a lot, actually, you know. And people just distort history to justify their current position. So just, you have to be, you can't, unfortunately, you just have to dig deeper. You just got to be a better scholar, I'm afraid. Another question. Yeah, exactly. You're allowed to do that. And then they're allowed to do whatever they do. You know. What is not spiritual abuse? I want to say this, because we are over time now, aren't we? I have what? 2 minutes? Yeah, okay. What's not spiritual abuse? Okay, making appropriate decisions for a ministry of church. We kind of talked about that. Refusing a position. That's not abuse. Disagreeing with a point of view, that's not abuse. Okay, now This is important because in our current culture, disagreeing with a point of view is abuse. You guys got that, right? You understand that? If I disagree with you, I've now abused you, and you've been harmed by my contrary opinion. This is all a bunch of poppycock, and it will eventually pass, but it'll probably have to get really crazy distorted before they pull it back. You know, so I mean, that's where we are. But that's not spiritual abuse. Teaching your religious or spiritual beliefs or morals isn't spiritual abuse. Okay? So if we say, you know, God says sexual relationships should be confined to a covenant of marriage between a man and a woman, that is not spiritual abuse to say so. All right? Or on the same line, articulating a clear set of theology and values, that's not spiritual abuse. Or requiring that your leaders should uphold your values and theology in their own lifestyle is not spiritual abuse. Okay, those things are not spiritual abuse. They're not a misuse of authority. In fact, they're your proper use of authority. But we live in the age when those who commit evil blame everybody else of the thing that they themselves are doing. And so that's how it goes. Welcome to the last days. All right, I'll take one last question, and then we'll probably got to call it. Three points on what is spiritual abuse?
No, on the whole talk, it was 3 points.
Get a warfare mentality, be a learner, put priority on connection and relationship, and be aware of a bunch of stuff.
That's the catch-all at the end.
Huh?
It's the catch-all at the end.
Catch-all at the end. One last question. Because the God of this world owns the land.
Yeah.
It's in the book. Well, spiritually, we're in a war, and we're trying to take the land away from him. But he's going to resist, isn't he? Like, if you're not doing anything kingdom-oriented, he'll let you, like, just buy a house all willy-nilly, whatever you want. But do it to go plant a church? Boom, all of a sudden, like, you can't find a house for love nor money. That's how it usually goes. You know, so you just got to pray more. You just got to pray. Keep praying. God will do something. And I will say this, there's always a breakthrough. There's always a breakthrough. We have weapons that are more than sufficient to overcome all the power of the enemy. But you got to use them. And we'll end it that way.